Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Hello and welcome to another Wittertainment podcast. I'm Simon Mayo.
And I'm Mark Kermode.
What do we have coming up in this next little kind of chunk, then?
We have loads of reviews. We have reviews of Monsters, the Gareth Edwards movie. We have reviews of Gods and Men, which was a prize winner at Cannes. We have Be All and End All, a British independent movie. We have Easier with Practice, indie film that won many awards. We have Megamind and much, much more.
Yes, and also Miracle Watch.
Yes, that's right. Fill us in on Miracle Watch, Father Simon.
All will be unveiled very shortly, but the inevitable progress to sainthood attainment continues in the next brief podcast moment.
Impeded only by the fact that we have to be A, Catholic, and B, no longer with us.
All will be explained in the next programme. Here we go. Talk Biffers, Riz Ahmed is going to be in the British Independent Film Awards.
Yes.
Though if you look at the films that win British Independent Film Awards, it's hard. People don't know what they're going to see, do they? Because they're big blockbusters, some of them.
Well,
Slumdog Millionaire, for example.
Yeah, although, bear in mind, Slumdog Millionaire, as I think we covered in quite some depth, although it obviously hasn't sunk in with you.
No, probably not.
Was a film that almost went straight to video. I mean, the funny thing about thinking of Slumdog as a blockbuster is that it happened after the fact. There are some films that are designed as blockbusters. They spend millions and millions of dollars on them. They have stars and special effects and all that sort of thing. And there are some films that we now think of as blockbusters because of the way that they were that they were greeted. Slumdog Millionaire still, to me, is the most extraordinary Oscar Best Film winner, because it was a film which is edgy, which is not entirely in the English language, which deals with some very tough subjects, including, you know, the abuse of children on the streets of a very, very tough city. And yet somehow became the feel-good film of the decade, went on to win the hearts and minds of everyone around the world, but was a film that almost didn't see the inside of a cinema. I mean, I think it's, in fact, that's a very good example.
Thanks.
Of
glad
a film
I pointed it out.
That can become a blockbuster, but clearly did not start life in that way at all.
All the lights are on. We are being live streamed. Go to the website and you can watch all the entertainment and you can count the amount of the number of cups of coffee which are consumed. See how I edited there?
Yes.
As
is it fewer or less? Or
I
lesser.
Think you will have more coffee
mm-hmm.
than last week. That's my guess.
Yeah, and people who go to lesser cinemas will have more coffee, right?
Caroline in Portsmouth says, I was at my local multiplex on Monday evening waiting for the next instalment of Harry Potter to begin. As the seats were all filling up, I noticed that my other half had broken, as we were not in Japan. Rule number 10 of your new code of conduct, which is
right.
No shoe removal.
No shoe removal.
Seeing as we had quite a while before the film started, being as fussy as I am about getting the right seats, and knowing that he had not been enlightened as I had, I thought I'd take the opportunity to get him to listen to a bit of the show where you read out the Ten Commandments. I whipped out my phone. This was before the film had started, so no rule breaking here. And I plugged in the headphones. A few minutes later, he chuckled and he put his shoes back on.
Very good.
So it got me thinking, do you think it would be possible to send the code out in some kind of slide or film format to be shown with the adverts before every film begins, so as to remind people of the correct cinema etiquette? Oh, for a slide format that we could all agree on.
Yes, or maybe even a film format. Is this a good moment to announce? Is that what you're building up
to? I'm teeing you up there.
Fine. So, due to huge popular demand, we have indeed created a public information film of the Wittertainment Code of Conduct. All 10 codes enacted by you.
Performed.
Performed. Yeah. By you, me, with a little help from James Naughty
James Boy King.
King,
yes, absolutely. Who just chirrups.
He just with a fantastic performance. And it's up now, it's on my blog, which is bbc.co.uk/Mark Kermode, although obviously it is jointly owned by you and me, and we advise anybody to go and have a look at it. But more importantly, we are going to attempt to get it into cinemas I say attempt, because we haven't actually done anything about this at all, and it may well be completely impossible. But wouldn't it be great if it was shown before films?
Yeah, I mean, clearly it's not going to go into the world of cinema or anywhere like that, because we say no eating, and the whole point is they're trying to shove food down our faces most of the time, so that isn't
yes.
going to happen.
Yeah, it may be a self-selecting group of cinemas that may show it. But go and have a look, and it's particularly fabulous. And you and I look particularly grumpy and miserable through the whole...
And pale and washed out.
Pale and washed out.
Orc. And Hawktree ride again. I imagine you can access from the 5 Live website.
So I'm sure you can. Tell me how.
bbc.co.uk/5live. Exactly. You look for our pages, and I imagine it will link to our piece of genius film.
Everything is all linked because the BBC is one big happy family.
Is that right?
It is.
You've been on too many courses. Dear Rhubarb and Custard, this is from Russ. Yes, indeed, the BBC's flagship film programme. Sorry, 10 minutes in, I hadn't mentioned that. After sitting next to the loudest popcorn eater ever to roam the earth during Harry Potter last week, I was over the moon to find this tub of sweets in a shop the next day. As it lines up exactly with the first point of the code of conduct, I thought you'd like to see it. So he's photocopied it. It's called Silent Mix, this pot of sweets.
Is this real or is this a photoshop
guy? No, this is real. And it looks as though it's from a company called Julian Graves. It's a confectionery treat of banana candy, shrimp candy, flying saucers and marshmallows. It may well give you, you know, a bad health situation in a few years.
Yes.
But it contains foam bananas, 29% foam bananas. And I imagine 11% flying saucers. It's got sodium hydrogen carbonate, but never mind all that.
No.
Shove it down your kids because it's silent.
Quiet.
You eat it, you can suck it and no one's going to notice.
The question is, will your kids be quiet after they have consumed the massive amounts of E numbers and sodium hydrocarbonate?
Well, that's true. This from V. Barbary. On Thursday, a rather anglicised American friend of mine posted a link to a YouTube video of Now Be Thankful by the Good Doctor's favourite folk rockers, Fairport Convention. Hello to them, by the way.
Hello to Fairport.
And I thought it'd be excellent taste you should be introduced to Wittertainment. So, his comment on your code of conduct. Their code of behaviour, he said, is very Gallic. That's you and me.
Very good.
Americans created the movie palace and like their popcorn and pop at the cinema. It was the French who decided that the cinema was a temple of art. Called me a Philistine, but it's still movies to me. So V is saying, are we aware of being very Gallic, and is this a bad thing?
Well, I mean, I don't think I've ever been called Gallic before, but obviously I will embrace my European side. You're Gallic anyway, right? Mayo, is that?
No.
Where's Mayo come from?
It's a derivation of Matthew and Mayhew.
So you Simon Matthew?
Well, in origin, Mayo came from Matthew, as many surnames come from first names.
Kermode comes from McDiarmid.
It's a really interesting sequence which we're moving into. Let me just mention the miracle from last week. We had an email from Grace Cassie, who told us the extraordinary story, and Mark didn't know what was going to happen at the end of this tale, so as I glanced up halfway through, you were indeed welling up, were you not?
Well, it's because I didn't know where the story was going. You just put on your slightly, you know,
our tune voice.
You did. Na, na, na. And I had no idea where this story was going, and I was genuinely concerned.
Well, this is the story of Grace Cass's friend, Andrew. So I'll just mention, just a recap for, in case you missed it last
week.
Shall
I do the RG music in the
background? No, because that would be very irritating.
Okay.
So Grace was telling us the story about her friend, Andrew, who's 34, keen runner and cyclist, who suffered a serious cardiac arrest while having dinner with friends. His heart stopped for around 45 minutes. He's kept alive by the CPR efforts of his heroic friend Lucas, police and paramedics who came along. He was taken to University College Hospital in London, put on life support. He hadn't regained consciousness. He was kept in a coma. The prognosis was not good. Do you remember this?
It completely went out of my head.
His family flew immediately from America. His body was chilled to a hypothermic state to protect his brain.
That's the bit I think that I find the most terrifying.
For some time, he was only able to make tiny movements and did not seem to be responding to voices. So they then realised that the only doctor that they hadn't tried was Dr. Kermode. So what they did is they rummaged through our archived podcasts and they found the Angels and Demons rant. So do you remember that as a particularly ranty rant?
Well, I remember being quite cross about Angels and Demons. Because the thing I remember about it was literally, whereas the original film was people running into rooms, standing still and explaining the plot to each other. The thing with Angels and Demons was it was people running and explaining the plot to each other at the same time. It was just endless running Basil exposition.
So that was the bit that they found on the archived podcast. And they played this section to their friend Andrew, who was in a coma. And, says Grace, he moved his head towards the speaker, from which was pouring Dr. K's splenetic outburst, and from there it was onwards and upwards. And Grace was writing to say that Andrew's awake, he's walking unaided, and he got married. So this is now past tense, because
they got married last Saturday, right? Congratulations to both of them.
To Hermione and to Andrew. And they're on honeymoon.
That's what happens after you get married, Tom.
Yes, that's right. We have a wedding photograph, which has been sent to us, which we will put online.
In which, I have to say, they're a very handsome couple, aren't they?
Indeed they are, as all our listeners are.
Yes.
We get to Biffa's later, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
So this from so this is what we got back from Andrew Gaines, now married to Hermione. Whether she's
we've had a correspondence since the wedding.
That's right. Okay, there you go. Right. It says this: Dear Don Fabrizio and Tancredi, still in awe of my dear friend Grace's syntactically superb email to the Witter Saints last week. I'm hesitant to add my 2 cents worth from the land of the leopard, where my wonderful wife Hermione and I very fortunately find ourselves on honeymoon this week. Rest assured that Jason Isaacs was duly greeted in an embarrassingly emotional groom's speech, while the ordeals recounting on last week's show was milked in the speech of my best man, David, a Yellowknife Canada native, who not incidentally introduced me to Wittertainment a few years back. Since the good doctor's part in The Awakening has already... This is a movie.
This is,
definitely.
Yes.
Has already been underlined. I want to extend my thanks to the world-class physicians and nurses at UCH and the Heart Hospital, whose care made my recovery and last week's nuptials possible. And, of course, the remarkable support of friends and family. I can tell you that my friend returned stateside duly impressed with the NHS, though there's certainly some scope for Jamie Oliver to try and improve the appalling food served to already sick people, says Andrew. Or perhaps I've misunderstood the medicinal effects of overcooked fish and chips and shepherd's pie. I would make one final plea, says Andrew, to all fellow listeners, as unbecomingly earnest as this part may be, refresh your CPR skills. You never know whose life you'll save at a dinner party. Andrew Gaines, collection of American and French diplomas.
Very good.
How about that?
Very good.
So congratulations to Andrew Gaines and Hermione. We will put their wedding photo up on our website.
Are we allowed to do that?
I don't know whether we have their permission.
Going to do it anyway.
Well, they tweeted it to us.
Yes,
so I reckon.
Right. It's
and then
the
we retweeted it.
Yes,
so
exactly.
As it's in the Twitter.
It's a bit late to start worrying about that now, kids.
But we might just go through the motions of saying that we've checked it with them.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Okay.
Have they agreed? I think they have.
I have agreed. Yes, that's great.
Is that all right, Andrew and Hermione?
That's right. Put it this way, if you're listening on the podcast and it's not all right, it's too late to say no.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what we should try and do at some stage in the... What we need to do is get some Angels and Demons rant available so that if you're feeling a little bit poorly today, then maybe... Because we just need to know whether it was a one-off miracle or whether there's genuine powers there. And we'll play some.
But that's like having, you know, when people have certain conditions, they run around with a thing, you know, in the case of something happening, administer this medicine. That's like running around with a little cassette. Well, not cassette. What do you have nowadays? People have iPods.
They probably do. James is listening to us while putting up his Christmas tree, which is a very nice thing.
James King?
No. Just James, who's he's following us on Twitter. You can follow us at Wittertainment, should you wish to know. Riz Ahmed is here. We're going to speak to him about the Biffers and about Four Lines. How are you doing, Riz? All right?
Yeah, not too bad, thanks.
We're just discussing our miraculous qualities just while you're with us. Peter, this from Martin. If Mark is considering canonisation as a career move, I think he should carefully consider the criteria first.
Being dead.
Basically, there are four main requirements. One, you must be responsible for two miracles. You can be beatified after one. So you could just be beatified. The miracles do, however, have to be verified by the Vatican. I'm afraid a text from a friend of the sister of the fiancé of the person who was cured does not count.
No, but interestingly, does count as far as the BBC is concerned. Yeah. That's fact-checking at its finest.
Two, you must have led a generally good and virtuous life.
Yeah, there
this
we go.
Can be a slightly tricky stage, as they will examine all your public writings and speeches. Let's hope they agree with you on The Exorcist. Unlikely.
Actually, that's the thing, if you run it by the Vatican, that's most likely to get you in. Because
On the other hand, Cardinal Newman was a pretty grumpy bloke by many accounts, and he's just been beatified, putting a strong emphasis on good doctor angle might help. Three, you have to be a Catholic. This is a bit of a tough one. There's not really any getting around that.
No.
Four, you have to, as you just mentioned, you have to be dead. This is possibly the most inconvenient requirement. In fact, you have to be very dead. The Vatican will not normally even begin considering you for saintliness until you've been dead for at least 5 years, and the miracles have to have been brought about after your deaths. Unfortunately, Andrew won't count anyway. So there you go.
So there we go. That's the end of
that. In summary, says Martin, a bit of a complicated process and possibly best to wait until you're a little less busy.
OK, if we can't get sanctified, any chance of being demonised?
Yeah, I reckon so. I reckon that's far more likely.
Yes, OK. Let's go for that then.
So let's do some... So this is the Angels and Demons rant, which, when played to Andrew, brought him out of his coma. It was the beginning of his process, then all the other doctors got in on the act.
Yeah,
we started it. So, yeah, the other doctors. So if you're just feeling a little bit under the weather and you feel as though you need the big hands, the big healing hands to stretch out of the radio and just touch you somewhere. Maybe you'll stop that. Let's just move forward and play a bit of this. Angels and Demons, Miraculous Time.
The first hour is as boring as ever, even though they're doing the running and explaining with the less bad haircut. The little bit after that, snore-inducingly bad. But the last 40 minutes are laugh-out-loud funny, and I guarantee if Gerry Anderson had come up with that plot for Thunderbirds or something, he would have torn the place up. The skydiving implications of it are so staggering. I mean, I don't want to give away... It's, in a way, I want to tell you what happens in the end because the end is so funny.
No, well, you can't.
I can't.
That, no.
But the end is so funny. Also, only Ron Howard could have directed the following two sequences as action sequences. Firstly, a trip to the Vatican Library, which turns into a nail-biting action sequence, only without the nail-biting. And secondly, the announcement of a new pope. You know how they announce a new pope? Smoke up the chimney?
Yes, white smoke.
Ron does the smoke going up the chimney as an action sequence. It's Mission Impossible goes to the Vatican with some Star Trek and Thunderbirds thrown in for good measure. It is stupid in ways that you could not possibly imagine. One Catholic paper took against it without having seen it and wrote a review saying it's evil and terrible, to which somebody wrote a counter review which said, "You are a man of great faith. You believe, though you have not seen." And that is a funnier joke than anything that's in the film.
I'm feeling better. I was just feeling a little tired at the beginning of that, but now I just feel rejuvenated.
Can I, because it's now been and gone, can I actually say what happens in the end of Angels and Demons? Because it's so long. I mean, nobody cares anymore, right?
Riz, did you see Angels?
I haven't, so I really want to know.
I don't want to spoil it for you. Need to see it.
No, seriously, please.
He's got the antimatter, right? Okay, if you don't want to know the end of Angels and Demons, turn off for the next 25 seconds, okay? Here we go. So Ewan McGregor gets the antimatter that's buried underneath the Vatican, runs out into the square, gets into a helicopter. The helicopter goes up into the air with the antimatter. The antimatter explodes, creating, let there be light, fiat looks. And then down from the exploding antimatter helicopter comes Ewan McGregor in a parachute. And he's got down into a celebrating crowd who are pretty much hailing him as the new Messiah. It is just... Team America had nothing on it.
And just retweeted, by the way, this is the photograph, let me show it to Riz. This is the happy couple, and there, Andrew is holding up a sign. This is his official wedding photograph, OK? Lots of people have official wedding photography, and it's nice, and you've got the nice gear, and maybe bridesmaids and so on. This is what Hermione and Andrew have got, them looking great, and a sign underneath saying, "Hello to UCH, Dr. K and Jason Isaacs."
Very good.
I'll forgive them for not mentioning me in that, because obviously...
Riz, since you're here, would you like to say hello to Jason Isaacs?
Hello, Jason Isaacs.
Very good.
Riz has not come along to be a part of any of this buffoonery. He's come to talk about the Biffers.
Well, he's in the wrong
stop
place.
Stop this then. Nonsense right
yes,
now.
Yes, absolutely,
please.
Right. Riz is from Four Lions, but the British Independent Film Awards are with us again. Tell us what you're up for with this, Riz.
What I'm...
What the film is.
Oh, what the film is. So Four Lions has got, I think, four nominations. It's got Best British Independent Film... the Douglas Hickox Award for Best Debut Director for Chris Morris, Best Actor for myself, and Best Supporting Actor for Kay Van Novak.
Very good.
That looks good, doesn't
so, yeah,
it?
We've got, yeah, it's great. It's lovely feeling. I think there's a couple of other films that are up for a few more.
In the Best British Independent Film category, you're up against Kick-Ass, which, of course, again, is another example of a film that was funded independently and was then sold to the studio finally, so it may have the trappings of a blockbuster movie, is actually an independent movie. The King's Speech, which... Have you seen that yet, Simon?
King's Speech, I hope I see it next week.
It's very interesting. I liked it very much. It's being it's a big awards contender. It's the one in which the king is taught to overcome his stammering through...
Made in Dagenham words.
Through Made in Dagenham words, yes. The cause of much Monsters, which we shall be reviewing later on today, although I think we have covered it to some extent, and Never Let Me Go. So, it's a strong field.
And Riz, in Best Actor category, is up against Jim Broadbent, Colin Firth, Scoot McNeary, again, who we learnt last week isn't called Scoot at all, but Brian or someone.
Yeah. Right.
And Aidan Gillen from Treacle Junior. So that's a pretty... you're looking at that, thinking, presumably, it's just great to be in that list, isn't it?
Now.
Go on, who do you think's going to win? Who do you think's going to win in the Best Actor category?
If it's not you.
Yeah. Who should you nobble?
Well, I just think Scoot's such a cool name.
We can all invent a name for ourselves.
Yeah, but not everyone's actually stuck to it.
You could be called Blazes.
He has on his list.
Is he Blazes Ahmed? You see that? Isn't that instantly more exciting?
Blazes Ahmed sounds
like
a horse.
When my career goes to America, that's what I'll call myself.
But is he coming over? Is he going to be at the awards?
I don't know. I hope so. I've never met him. I've met Aidan. I did a kind of TV movie with him, He's a lovely guy.
Yes.
So it'd be lovely if he won. I haven't really met the. I've met Colin Firth very briefly, when just after he won an award for Single Man. He seems like a lovely guy. But to be honest, I haven't seen any of these other films. Okay, I've seen Kick-Ass, and I love that film.
I would say that he's the one to watch, Colin Firth in King's Speech. That's the one he's I think he's your most difficult challenge in that category.
By the way, are you suggesting that he's going to beat me?
No, I'm saying that he's the most difficult challenge in that category, Riz, which is why I used those words very specifically.
BBC was meant to be an impartial organisation.
Riz, I'm not saying he should win. I'm saying he is your strongest competitor. If you were...
I agree.
Up against him, that's, you know, that...
No, would you say it's going to take me down?
Yeah, would you say Riz is sort of Qatar against Australia?
I don't know what that means.
Qatar against Australia.
Yeah. Is that a sporting analogy?
Can I say if you were touched and healed by the angels and demons, if you do feel better, can you get in touch, because we just need to pass it all on?
Okay.
85058. If you do feel better having listened to it, people want more here. Rob in Bristol. I am poorly at home with a blocked ear, which is causing me lots of pain in a manly way. I feel that an A-grade rant would be an appropriate remedy to shift my stubborn wax and relieve the pressure. OK, but, well, you just have to hang on, because we'll do some new movie stuff very shortly. How did you get involved with Chris Morris? Because if he... Let's talk about you and talk about him, given that you're both up for categories in the Biffers. So
I met him after I'd... I think Road to Guantanamo had just come out, which is my first film.
Yes.
I left drama school to take that film, so I was just, you know, fresh. That was my first job.
And Road to Guantanamo was made for TV, wasn't it? It was a Channel 4 production?
That's right.
Yeah,
it was also released, I think it was one of those simultaneous releases.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was on the internet and in cinemas and on TV at the same time. I think it was the first film to do that, which is cool. But so I had that film had just come out, and I think I'd also just released my first song, accidentally released it. It kind of leaked out into the ether. It was called the Post 9/11 Blues. It was this kind of satire about the post 9/11 circus of surreal fear and madness. And he kind of got in touch through Matt Whitecross, he just wanted to meet up with me, and I just met up with him and just talked about everything and nothing, and we carried on doing that every couple of months for about 3 years. We just meet up and kind of, you know, he may mention that, yeah, he was working on this thing, and we'd kind of maybe touch on the idea of radicalism or whatever every now and again, but really it was just kind of general chats. So over the course of like 3 years, I was putting him in touch with friends, people that ended up becoming researchers on Four Lions, and we just kind of struck up this kind of friendship, I guess.
And if you were explaining it to friends, did you say it's a comedy about suicide bombers? I mean, is that it?
That's a sentence. That's the neatest way. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
And their reaction was what?
Ha ha ha. Usually.
Ironically? No. Sarcastically?
No,
or hilariously?
Yeah, I'm just actually in pain, because I can't actually look. I'll try.
So you're laughing inside.
Exactly. But they seem to really go for it. I mean, everyone on the Biffa jury and everyone who's voted, so that's a really nice feeling, because I think the Biffas are an opportunity for much smaller films that get, you know, often get made against the odds, to get some recognition. And I'm really interested in seeing Monsters as a film that I've heard was made on a shoestring.
Yes, 500,000, really, yeah. And extraordinary. I mean, you do remember just how much there was a collective intake of breath when it was revealed that Four Lions was happening. Because I remember reading articles about it saying, it's what? It's a comedy about suicide bombers. And everyone going, is it possible to do that? And I liked the film very, very much. And I reviewed it here and in The Observer. And I bumped into Chris Morris in the street. I used to know him from Radio 1. And he said, oh, I read your review. You said that you didn't think it was funny at all and you thought that was a good thing. And I said, yeah, that's exactly what I thought, because I didn't laugh. I thought it was a really good film.
Did you not?
And then he, no, I didn't. And he said an interesting thing about it was, but I like it very much. I mean, I thought it's funny, but it's not a laugh out loud funny. It's actually deeply sad. And he said, the interesting thing is the younger audiences laugh a lot more and the older audiences do much more what you're doing, which is sit there and be concerned about it. And he said, frankly, as far as he was concerned, perfectly happy with that. I mean, I think it's a really interesting, really brave, intelligent film. And the idea of it being a comedy is, you know, confrontational. The fact that I was using it as an example of the fact that I didn't find it funny did not mean that it didn't work. Actually, the reason I didn't find it funny was because it did work. Because actually, all the rubber dinghy rapids and the, you know, the liking stuff is heartbreaking. And that's actually at the heart of it, that it's not that funny.
Right, that's really interesting. That's a really kind of strangely positive review.
Good.
I've heard.
A comedy.
It's a comedy. It's really comedy, not funny at all.
Yes.
But
a comedy
really
that's
good.
Not funny, but...
No, thanks.
So it was succeeding on what level then?
Because I thought it did exactly what I think in the end Chris Morris set out to, because although he is a comedian, I think he has a more serious purpose in the film, which is it is actually a look at people who's, you know, and how they've got themselves into this situation without it having loads and loads of backstory. It's a genuinely interesting film about people in a desperate situation, and it's not pompous. It is a comedy, but I just didn't find it funny.
Ollie in London on this email. We'll come back and do some more with Riz in just a moment. I have been feeling really down today, says Ollie, really down. Snow everywhere and I'm flat broke. Then in the middle of the Angels and Demons clip, I received an email from a client saying he's just paid me. So I can go out tonight after all.
That's three.
You're almost, apart from the fact that you haven't led an impeccable life, you're not Catholic and you're not dead, you're so close. So close. I make music. I'm also an actor, he says on his Twitter page. He's been tweeting, haven't you, Riz?
I did. I just tweeted. I said, Mark Commode says that Four Lions was totally unfunny, but that it was brilliant because of that. I don't know how to feel about that.
Lol.
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 I can only write lol. I can't actually laugh. We've been through this already. Yeah. I'm really chesty at the moment.
That's true. But if you're 17, you can say lol as a word, as I've discovered.
I'm going to be doing that for the rest of the show.
Is that right?
Yeah.
There you go. Look, I've lolled. How about that?
Very good.
That's very. If you want to follow Riz, he's Riz MC, which is what is. That's how you make music. You're at Riz MC, but that's your kind of musical
name.
Name. I was trying to think of something else.
It is. Yeah. Monica?
You couldn't call yourself Monica. You don't look like that at all. Thank you very much.
MC
I'm here
Monica.
All week. Tip your waitress.
So, yeah, no, I do make music. I've got this album out in January. And actually, sometimes they kind of collide because this debut album has a short film that goes with it, which is the first short film that I've directed. And it also has this kind of very strange interactive video game website for the album as well. And I'm just really interested in kind of where all these mediums converge, you know, music, film, web games. And for the Microscope album, there is a short film and a web game. There's also a live show that's kind of very strange and interactive and immersive. And we've done that at theatre spaces and nightclubs and festivals like Latitude. So I think there is kind of space for cross-pollination of these things, which is why sometimes I tweet about film on the at-rhythm scene.
I was going to say that Noah and the Whale released their last album as an album and a film simultaneously, didn't they? There was a 35-minute film that came out. You could buy the two of them together. I mean, it is happening more and more.
Well, when we were talking to Gareth Edwards last week about Monsters, about this film, which we'll be reviewing later, we were just sort of scratching the surface of this, really, which gets us back to independent films as to whether now is potentially the greatest time to have talent and maybe just a decent camera, because that's what he did. He and a couple of mates, they went on holiday. He had £1,000 camera, but it's all, you know, it looks like a blockbuster movie. Clearly they're fantastically talented people, but they went out and they didn't wait to get given a gig by some studio. They just went and made it. So if you have the talent and a bit of cash, maybe now is the best time to be an independent filmmaker.
Yeah, maybe. I think everyone learned a lesson from Paranormal Activity as well.
What was the lesson they
the lesson was don't
that?
Do it twice. Funny the first time.
Well, just that they made a film on their own, didn't they, from a shoestring, and they ended up, you know, rolling out across the USA and grossing a ridiculous amount of money. And again, it's a film that's made perhaps not with you know, much means, but it ends up punching above its weight. Those are the kind of films that I'm excited by. That's why I think the Biffers are a really cool event, actually, because I think the kind of films that we're very good at making at in Britain are those alternative, maybe slightly countercultural stories. And I think they end up punching above their weight because of that.
But you know what's interesting about that list, that Best British Independent Film nominations list, Four Lions, as we've said, you know, a comedy about suicide bombers, Kick-Ass, a big, splashy comic book adaptation.
But still very alternative.
No,
didn't want to touch that because it was so cutting edge.
You're absolutely correct. The King's Speech, which is, you know, as close as it gets to a heritage movie, but actually happens to be a heritage movie about somebody learning not to stammer through, learning to swear. Monsters, which is on one level a Spielbergian... that's a very, very diverse list. And what's interesting about that, you're right, they're all alternative films, but they are not what I think, you know, in the past used to be what Ken Russell's mother used to refer to as a British picture, meaning a boring film shot in black and white about people sitting around sinks, you know. So it does, I think there's a great diversity in that list, but you're right, they are all left-field movies in very different ways. Mm.
I think that's where our kind of strength lies as a film industry, and I think that's a natural position for us to kind of slot into. We've got this giant of an English-speaking neighbour in the American film industry in Hollywood. I kind of think that makes sense. That's a sense of freedom for us, you know, in terms of we've got the potential to tap into that massive audience, but I don't think it's by offering more of the same, you know. On one level, we don't have the budgets to make Hollywood-type films, but I think that's something to embrace and try and make slightly alternative stories.
And just
on the budget thing, I think when you see Monsters, it'd be interesting to know what you make of it. Maybe you should tweet it. We'll follow you on that, because I don't think anyone will go to see that film and think, that was done for under $1 million, because yeah. And when Gareth was here last week, he was explaining how he did it, and you did a film for the Culture Show, Mark. He did the effects on his laptop, but they're great special effects. Yeah. You know, you don't need to have that unbelievable budget from a huge studio make a big film.
But you've worked with, for example, the micro-budget project, which is Shifty, was made for a staggeringly small amount of money.
I've actually just made another micro-budget film as well. And I think Shifty was one of those films where the scale of the story might have implied that it wasn't a big budget film, because it was, in one sense, like more domestic. And I wouldn't say it's necessarily part of the kitchen sink tradition, particularly we've got that kind of Hollywood thriller-esque ending with the twist. And I think that's, you know, what a lot of Aaron Creevy's influences come from. But I don't think people left and thought, okay, that was made on a camcorder for nothing. I think you can pull things off on a shoestring. I mean, talking about effects on a laptop, my music video that I've just put, that's just gone up, is a Blade Runner remake, and it's a
aim low.
Exactly, it's a homage to Blade Runner, and we made it for nothing. And it was just one amazing guy, really driven, who wanted to try out doing all these effects on his laptop, and the results are absolutely blinding. I think it's the most impressive music video I've ever made, and I think, as you said, kind of technology is just in the hands of everyone now. Mm. And where there's a will, there's a way.
And where do you stand on the BFI having taken over from the rump of the UK Film Council, BFI and Film London? What's your position on that?
I don't know. I don't know about the intricacies of film finance. I just think it's good news that the money isn't completely disappearing from the film pot.
Well, in fact,
has it?
Yeah, apparently so. Yes.
Right. So that's good news. As long as there are avenues to get films funded, and maybe that from the off don't sound like very commercial films. I think Four Lions was a film that a lot of people didn't want to touch, but in the end, it's ended up doing very well. I think as long as there are avenues to get that startup financing, then we're all happy.
Dear St. Peter and St. Paul, says Rebecca, please tell Riz Ahmed I laughed like a drain during Four Lions. I don't know why Mark didn't laugh. It was funny. It was Penguin Party that did it for me. I also loved Shifty. She signs off, lol.
Hey.
There you go. And this coming through at Widdertainment from Paul, if I can just get that right. Four Lions, he says, nowhere near as funny as the Three Lions that failed with the World Cup bid and did so badly in South Africa. A little topical.
I do want to be clear, and I can refer you back to my review of it when you weren't in the studio. So
it was
I'm not
a positive
nice.
Review.
It was solidly positive. It's just, and it was interesting. It was around. There was a couple of films around at that time that were making me question whether or not, in order to be successful, a comedy actually has to make you laugh. And of course, if you look at the, I'm sure you have, if you look at the DVD extras on Four Lions, there's a couple of accompanying documentaries, little short featurettes about real life kids in those areas, which it's interesting that rather than having gag reels and outtakes, what actually you got was a couple of documentaries about people, growing up in those areas and dealing with those situations in a very serious way, which I thought was completely in keeping with the fact that I didn't find it funny. But I don't say that as a criticism.
Listener Steve, who for some reason says age 45 at the end of this, Four Lions, one of the best films I've seen. Very funny and thought-provoking. For me, it's up there with Life of Brian in its satirising depiction of extremist religious faith and dogma. I thought it was brilliant and the acting was excellent.
Oh, thank you very much.
What are you going to be working on next? You've got the micro budgets and you've got your music.
Yeah.
The next sort of big screen adventure?
I mean, I enjoy doing all of those. So, as I said, the album's out. This Blade Runner video has just gone up. And the next micro-budget film I just did was Ill Manners, directed by Ben Drew. Plan B, who I think is a really interesting guy, a real cinephile, and I wanted to be a part of that project. It's quite an uncompromising, brutal story. If you've heard his first album, then you'll be familiar with the kind of stories he tells set in and around East London. And so I just shot that, and then right off the back of that, just went out to Tunisia to do a much, much bigger film than anything I've done before, directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud. I'm playing brothers with Taha Rahim from A Prophet. Mm. And it's a great cast. It's Mark Strong, Antonio Banderas, And it's just, it was a bit like Disneyland. It was very strange. It was just kind of like, you know, you've got like 300 camels, 200 horses, you know, great. 600 extras and, yeah, aeroplanes diving for your head.
Is that a micro-budget film as well?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
What voice is Mark Strong using?
Sean Jacquard's doing it all on his laptop.
I want to know what accent Mark Strong is doing.
He's doing an Arabic accent. He described it to me as Arabic accent 3.2.
He's very good.
He's great.
Riz, good having you on the programme. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much.
And break a leg at the Biffers over the weekend.
Cheers. Yeah. Thanks, guys.
Because you're not expecting to win. That's the best place to be. Exactly. Nominated, you can sit there and relax.
Exactly.
Someone who tweets as S. Bedvec. I'm not sure if I can shorten that at all. No, I don't think I can. Anyway, he's taken in an early showing of HP7A. He says on Wednesday he's got the perfect cinema-going snack. Croissant. Because it makes absolutely no noise. And he says that is basically what should be on offer.
Do you know why croissant is called croissant? Because it's shaped like a croissant.
Abigail May says, I am at home from work in Leeds with my two-year-old who was spectacularly sick over my long-suffering childminder this morning. As the Angels and Demons rant came on, he turned over, sighed, settled down and is now peacefully asleep. Another miracle. Andy Mayo, no relation, he says. I've been feeling a little bit poorly with one of those headaches that sort of thump a bit low down the back of your head. After listening to Angels and Demons, I feel slightly better. As a man of faith, I presented the back of my head to the radio rather than turning my back on, and I feel this may have aided the healing process. This is amazing work you're doing. Lou in Chorley, if Mark can perform miracles, perhaps he can get my 16-year-old to do some revision for A-level law. He's listening to the show for the first time live as he's not in college. Go on, do
some revision.
A bit lifeless, wasn't it, really?
Sorry, he wants singing and dancing.
Matt Thomas, I injured my knee in August. I've had two operations on it. 2 weeks ago, I had my left anterior cruciate ligament repaired using my right hamstrings. I have not walked for weeks. Following the good doctor's rant, a chap delivered 25 kg bag of rock salt that I ordered online to make my drive less slippy. I am considering a jog around Newcastle in the snow. On second thought, perhaps I'll just watch you on the webcast. Almost certainly a lot safer. Mayo, could you ask the good doctor on this text, it says, to touch the speaker in the manner of a CD TV evangelist? If he could do that in a deep southern voice, I think it would make him almost invincibly powerful, says Lee. Alison in Ware, I'm in bed with tonsillitis, feel very sorry for myself, but the sainted doctor's just made me smile. I have managed to eat a yoghurt, and that is proof of any miracle. If you can eat a yoghurt,
so
you're better.
Off beast, haven't you?
Have I?
Yes.
Chris in Belfast, I've just opened the window, turned up the volume very loud, and can successfully report that your voice is melting the dreaded snow. National chaos resolved. Finally, for the moment.
Can I review a film?
Reese Cousins in Cardiff. I have to say, I started this day by being a non-believer. Whilst I found the stories of canonised Kermode amusing, that's all there was to it, amusing. I am now a believer. I was at the kitchen sink preparing to wash up all the pots and pans from last night's lemon chicken. This is normally a complicated procedure, which involves taking the washing up bowl up to the bathroom and filling it with hot water before returning to the kitchen to complete said cleaning duties, as the hot tap over the sink has been broken for a while. And not being a plumber, it's easier to do this than start unscrewing tap-type things. Imagine my delight when returning to the kitchen with a bowl full of hot water, I hear a Commodian rant about angels and demons, and water begins to trickle from my hot tap. I've now turned it on and off about 20 times. The water is flowing strong. It's flowing hot. Praise the Kermode, says Reese Cousins in Cardiff. You're the Uri Geller of 2010.
Yeah, I think that's what I am.
There are some new films out.
There are. We'll do top 10 after 3 o'clock. I want to tell you about Of Gods and Men, which is a new film by Xavier Beauvoir, which won the Grand Prix at Cannes. You remember last week we had Uncle Boon, or maybe a couple of weeks ago, we had Uncle Boon Me, which won the Palme d'Or. So this is described as being loosely based on the Tiberian tragedy, 1996. I just want to be very clear about the film is loosely based on the life of the Cistercian monks in Algeria from 1993 until their capture in 1996. The story is of a monastery within an Islamic area in which there is a coexistence of the Christian monks and the Islamic people. What happens very, very early on is that there is militia stuff going on around, and the monks learn that their monastery is potentially under threat because the militia want to have them out of there, despite the fact that actually what they do with their time is minister to everyone around, particularly the local residents who are very, very poor, and they minister in many ways, including, most notably, medicine. One night, the militiamen turn up, having apparently just committed some terrorist act, and demand to be looked after and to be and to have their wounds tended to. And the leader of the monastery sort of stands up to them, says, "We don't have arms in here. Obviously, we will try and help you as much as we can, but please bear in mind this is Christmas that you've come." And actually, there's an interesting moment of engagement between the two religious cultures, but the backdrop of all of this is they have to make a decision, which is whether they should stay where they are and carrying on ministering to their flock, or whether they should leave because they are told by the authorities that they are in great danger. The authorities, it has to be said, also are not in any way sympathetic towards them. And in one very important encounter, the leader of the monastery speaks to some figure in authority who says, "Look, the fact of the matter is, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it's your colonialist heritage that has caused all this in the first place. So don't come moaning to me when I'm telling you that you are putting yourself in danger and you don't have my sympathy." Now, that's interesting because when the film played at Cannes, there was some criticism that what the film did was depicted, on the one hand, the monks as wholly good, and that somehow the film took a stance which was profoundly pro-Christian and therefore anti. I don't believe that's the case at all. I think what the film manages to do, and there's a very, very interesting sentence in the notes describing the tone of the film, which says the film is more interested in capturing the spirit of the events and what was at stake within the community than in recounting the exact details of historical reality. The monks called the army the Brothers of the Plain and the terrorists the Brothers of the Mountain. Far from naive, they were aware that they were walking a fine line between the two of these ambiguous positions. Essentially, what you get is a drama about people in an enclosed situation in which they have to decide philosophically, religiously, spiritually, whether by their own lights they should stay or they should go. And it is, for the most part, a film about people wrestling with their faith. It is a film in which people have discussions that, to some extent, reminded me of, you remember in Land and Freedom, there's a point when everything stops and they have a big political discussion about, you know, anarcho-syndicalism and socialism. An awful lot of Gods and Men is the monks very quietly deciding between themselves whether what their mission is to stay and help, or whether what their mission is to go, wrestling with their own faith. There are many moments in which we see people literally having an ongoing wrestling match with their own belief. There's one monk who cries out, you know, "Do not abandon me, do not abandon me," because his faith is failing him. There are a couple of moments in which the monastery is seen as being threatened, in one extraordinary sequence by a helicopter which flies over the monastery and appears to have almost like Apocalypse Now, and the monks respond by prayer, by singing. And some people have suggested that what happens is that there's a suggestion that the prayer and the singing actually drives the helicopter away. I saw it in a completely different way. I just saw it as actually them resolving to accept whatever it is that happens to them. The most extraordinary thing about the film is that for a film in which the action is really, really sort of small detail, I found it breathtakingly moving. And I don't think you have to be religious or you have to have a specific religious take on it. And I incidentally don't think for one minute the director, Xavier Beauvoir, whose previous work includes, you know, a film about AIDS, a film about Policier, he's somebody who immerses himself in the world in which he is depicting. The film has an extraordinary cast of faces, I mean, from middle age to older age. And it spends an awful lot of time, like that documentary, Into Great Silence, which was a documentary, literally a documentary depiction of living within a kind of, you know, a monastic existence. What you have is this sense of people together in a world which they have created for themselves, attempting great philosophical discussions, somehow having a transcendent discussion with the audience without ever appearing to be doing anything as, you know, as boldly pretentious as that. It's extremely moving. It's beautifully acted. It builds up to a sort of, you know, an inevitable climax, which is done with great sensitivity and great calm. It's an ensemble cast who do not put a foot wrong. It's one of those films that makes you think, you know, I would never, if somebody described that film to me as, you know, this is what the film's like, you think, okay, well, that's not going to be that interesting. It's moving, it's profound, it's beautifully acted, its heart is in the right place. And I think it's really genuinely exceptional and a late entry to top 10 of the year.
If you had to choose between anarchism and anarcho-syndicalism?
Well, anarcho-syndicalism, obviously. Because anarchy is let's smash everything up. Anarcho-syndicalism is let's smash everything up, but in an organised, cooperative way.
Oh, so that's kind of... Yes. Okay, that's sort of reassuring. There was an item that we started on last week's programme where we discuss items in the news.
Yeah.
And this was apparently a bad idea and we were asked to desist.
Oh, were we?
Yeah. But I just thought I'd mention, having heard some...
And told me.
Some World Cup stuff there, I just thought I'd mention, you know, whenever I see Sepp Blatter, there's one quote that I remember more than any other.
Which is?
And that is when he was asked about the popularity of women's football, he said, if they want to get more popular, they should just wear shorter shorts. And that's the guy at the top. That's what you have to remember.
Can I very quickly check in?
Yes, Are you going to talk about this? Is that something about the news?
No, I just want to check in one further sentence about Of Gods and Men, which I didn't say before 3 o'clock, but this is important. And I do think in the end that the film is about, you know, spirituality in all its many different ways, in all its many different forms, and it is about religious tolerance, and it's about the way in which we express those ideas. There is a sequence in the film, quite near the end of it, in which the monks all sit down together and have a meal. And you may be inclined to read this as a Last Supper thing, or you may not, but they have a meal, and they eat and they drink, and they put on a tape of Swan Lake, and the camera looks individually at each one of the monks sitting around, and their faces break into these smiles. And I have to tell you, it's one of the most moving scenes I've seen. And
did you well up?
Without wishing to sort of, it's not to do with just welling up. I mean, I'm thinking about it now, I'm feeling quite moved, but it is one of those things. It was profoundly moving. It was a profoundly moving sequence. Just this sequence of these guys with a tape recorder sitting around listening to Swan Lake eating, and they smile, which there hasn't been that much smiling up until that point. And it was dramatic in a way that demonstrated that, you know, that thing that Danny Boyle said, that, you know, you blow up planets and you do all the rest of it, but in the end, what cinema does is it takes the human experience and puts it up there on the screen, and it magnifies everything. And in fact, that's what it's about. And I can't think of a better recent example of a film doing exactly that.
I'm slightly disconcerted because I feel as though you've just reviewed the movie of the week, and
I just wanted to start on that because the fact of the matter is
I feel as though it's 1 minute to four.
No, there
and
are bigger.
I've said anything else, and you go, oh yes, movie.
No, but you know why? Because there are bigger blockbusters than the rest of it. But I wanted to actually to tell you how much I like this film.
What's
at the beginning.
Again?
It's called Of Gods and Men.
Okay.
Okay.
Box office top 10 in just 1 second. Just a couple of listeners in Australia have mentioned this. Andrew Jolly in Brisbane and Pete Murphy, who's in Australia as well. He says, please don't correct my grammar. I never learnt good grammar at school in England. But anyway, Pete says, I'm writing to inform you that the reputation of The Good Doctor has now infiltrated the foreign media.
What?
I've just been listening to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, ABC, commentary of the current Adelaide Test match. To my surprise, I heard the name of The Good Doctor being discussed by the commentators, Kerry O'Keefe and our own Jonathan Agnew. Mr. Agnew was discussing the recent Australian World Cup presentation bid introduced by Hugh Jackman. Hugh Jackman. Jonathan explained that he had recently spoken to The Good Doctor, who referred to Hugh Jackman as Hugh Jackson. Not only were the English briefly on top in the cricket... But the Australian cricketing audience has now been subjected to the comedy genius of wordplay that is Dr. Kerr.
But that wasn't my joke. I think it was your joke. Or a listener.
Thank you, I'll take credit.
Almost certainly a listener in the same way as, you know, all the best.
And Andrew's made the same point, but he says... He just thinks we'd like to know that we were discussed as part of the last test.
That's great.
He says, I'd be very grateful to you both for providing the soundtrack to my commute in Brisbane. In Queensland. Also, just quickly, I introduced the marvels of Wittertainment to a good friend of mine in Sydney, and I'm afraid she's developed a rather unhealthy obsession with all things Kermode. It would quite literally, I believe, make her life so far, capital L, capital S, capital F, if you could say hello to Miss Alison Ross in Sydney, Australia.
Hello, Alison Ross in Sydney, Australia.
Her life is complete.
Kermode and Mayo's film review. The UK cinema top 10.
5 Live.
Box office top 10 out of 10, it's Machete or...
Machete, which started life as a trailer and probably should have ended life as a trailer. That's what happens when you expand something that is a trailer length into a full-length feature film. But then Roger Corman made an entire career out of doing just that. So it's not new, it's just nothing like as... funny as it ought to be.
Skyline is at number 9.
So, you know, again, it's held on there. How many weeks has that been in now? Can you see? Is it 4, 5?
I'm not equipped
It'll say
for
on
that
the,
information.
Yeah, you are. It's on the right-hand side of the...
It's being chopped.
Okay, fine. I mean, it's, as we said before, I didn't think it was terrible. A lot of people did see it and did think it was terrible and got in touch
with me. It looks like
the
beginning of a number three. I can just see a little curly bit at the top and a curly bit at the bottom.
So it's either 3 or 8. I think it must be 3. But it's certainly nothing like as good as Monsters, which we'll come to later on. But it's not the worst film of the year. I'm sorry that people thought it was.
Jackass 3D.
Jackass. Yes, that's right. Yes, Rich said Jackass.
Rich says Jackass.
It is definitely Jackass 3D. First 20 minutes, funny. People hitting each other with big polystyrene hands. After that, just gets into the, you know, excrement stuff, which I do not understand and I don't particularly want to see in 2D or 3D.
Girl who kicked the hornet's nest at 7.
You know, up from the second part, I mean, the way the trilogy worked, part one, great, part two, lost the plot, part three, partial return. For there is, as we know, a David Fincher American language remake coming, although as far as I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, they're filming it in Sweden, but in American with accents, probably. I don't know how that's going to work. It does look somewhat televisual. It's not going to be hard for David Fincher to make it more cinematic, but I think that in terms of the cast they had and in terms of the length of time we spent with those characters, this was actually a fairly satisfying ending, although it has an epilogue ending, the last 10 minutes of it, which are complete baloney. So at the point at which it looks like it's ended, leave. Why are you pulling that face?
It's my natural face.
Okay.
Despicable Me is at 6.
Well, Despicable Me, interesting only because Megamind is out this week and it's essentially the same film. We'll get to
the poster, you know. Looks very much like The Incredibles.
Yeah, and the plot is enormously like
The Incredibles,
okay. And like Despicable Me, and a little bit like the, you know, the what's it character out of Kick-Ass.
The Americans at 5.
The American.
I said,
are you the American,
apostrophe
S?
The Americans at 5.
The Americans at 5. Well, that's like the sequel. There's loads of George Clooney's running around in snowbound locales being photographed very beautifully by Anton Corbijn. I don't think it's a substantial work. I think that it's essentially riddled with cliche, but the stylishness which Corbijn brings to the project redeems it. It is, in the end, however, the story of the guy, the lone guy, holes up in a remote area, the physical and the spiritual depicted by the priest and the prostitute, which is pretty much as cliched as you can get. But Anton Corbijn does manage to find, you know, cinematic pleasure in the assembly of the rifle and in looking at George Clooney, who is genuinely, he has a cinematic face and he has a face that the camera loves.
It's The American and The Vicar and The Tart. That's what it is.
That's right.
Dominic Johnson, on an email, he went to see The American. He had a terrible time vis-a-vis Code of Conduct.
Oh, really? Okay.
Seats that smelt of damp dogs, mobile phones, crowds of youths, games of musical chairs. But he says because of the advert for The American, people were expecting some sort of James Bond crash bang film.
Yeah.
And because the film
isn't anything like that at all.
Exactly. And, you know, gradually matures, he says, much like the original Day of the Jackal, the public got bored. My generation does not have the attention span of longer than 5 minutes. He says, my policy towards the rules in the cinema is becoming much more right-wing, which is a shame as I'm only 23. Which makes the assumption that authoritarianism is something to do with being right-wing as opposed to left-wing, which we
could discuss. Yeah, because let's face it, Stalin was totally non-authoritarian.
Not at all. So he's linking the fact that it was a misleading trailer, so everyone goes in thinking it's James Bond, and they get an Anton Corbijn film, which is not quite the same.
I think what they ought to have is a trailer which says, you know Le Samurai? You know Existential Despair?
Bit like
you
that.
You know Snow? If you like them, you'll like this.
Due date's at 4. This from Thelma. Who's this from? Trevor. Just been to see Due Date. Truly awful. A recycled road movie script and some scenes that were just plain nasty rather than funny. Is it too much to hope that we've now seen the end of the milking of the success of The Hangover itself, a highly overrated
movie? Hangover 2 is coming. And, I mean, this, of course, we referred to this as Hangover 2, but there really is going to be a Hangover 2. At least it was listed on the IMDb. I believe it's happening. The sad thing is that in the way things are at the moment, this actually wasn't by any means in the lower end of this kind of comedy. It was, you know, Robert Downey Jr. was something to watch. And so there has been... I mean, people say, I don't have a sense of humour. Clearly, I didn't find Four Lions funny, so I've just kind of bolstered that. But I do think we have been in a fairly parlous period in terms of really good screen comedies recently.
London Boulevard's at 3.
Which, you know, is kind of, I mean, again, is a throwback thriller. It was interesting that it came out the same week as The American. Stylishly done, ultimately empty, therefore, perhaps. But it's like a rehash on the themes of Sunset Boulevard. And there are individual riffs which work well in it. I thought Colin Farrell was actually very good, despite... a certain amount of accent uncertainty, but actually that won't matter outside of England.
But David Thewlis is worth the price of admission alone.
He is, and some people have compared him to the role to Withnail, as in Withnail and I. Mm-hmm. And there is a little bit of a crossover between him and Richard E. Grant, and he does literally chew up the scenery and enjoy the dialogue, rolls the dialogue around his mouth like a fine wine, the finest wines known to humanity.
Unstoppable at 2.
It's a runaway train movie directed by Tony Scott. There's a train. It runs away. Tony Scott chases it. There are two blokes. Will they stop it? Who knows? What do you think?
Tough guess.
Yeah. It's unremarkable. It's remarkably unremarkable, but it does what it says in the packet.
Johnny Walker, but not that one, says, I recently watched and enjoyed Unstoppable, yeah, but was wondering if anyone else noticed the astonishingly awful parenting behaviour exhibited by the hero's wife. For a large amount of the film, she was repeatedly shown with her young son as they both watched in terror as the film's hero, her husband,
her estranged,
narrowly escaped being turned into a human pudding. Not only that, but what she was content to do during this, she was going to do this in the middle of a potential disaster area. I found the whole matter rather distracting, not a little irritating. Not once did she attempt to shield the eyes of her son, nor did she attempt to extract him to somewhere less likely to become known as the next Chernobyl, anyway.
No, I know, but also, that's another film riddled with cliché. He's the bloke, he's had the thing with his partner, which will be resolved by him doing the thing on the train. The other bloke is the old grizzled bloke, you know, he's just on his last hurrah, he's just, you know, he's virtually on his last day, and now he has to save the train. In the real life story, the train did run for 66 miles, but it ran at a top speed of 47 miles per hour. And in the real case, they chased it with the train and caught it.
Three
and
comments.
Slowed it down to 11 miles an hour and then stopped it.
Three comments on Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1, yep. HP 7A, which is, of course, still at number one. Luke Taylor. Simon, as well as some listeners, have commented that the tenting about portion of the film seems a bit long. I would say this is intertextually motivated because J.K. Rowling includes several chapters of this in the source book. This mm-hmm. peripatetic camping interlude is necessary to establish the three kids' confusion and frustration. Second, there are three unsung acting performances worth noting. The actors, including David O'Hara, and I can't remember the names of the others, who play the Ministry of Magic employees whose bodies are appropriated by Harry, Ron and Hermione through the use of Polyjuice Potion.
Whose bodies are appropriated.
O'Hara, in particular, is completely convincing, playing a teenager in the body and clothes of a middle-aged man, unsteadily stalking about in an unfamiliar body and unfamiliar clothes in an unfamiliar setting whilst trying hard to escape notice. Well done to them.
Yeah.
Stuart Swainson. I am in the minority, being in the tiny sliver of the middle of the Venn diagram that is people who enjoy the movies and those who've never read the books. As such, I was pleased to hear that the first installment of the last book worked as a single movie-going experience and happily handed over my pennies to my local world of cine. While I enjoyed seeing the same faces slightly more grown up and playing wizards again, I did feel like it was a bit of a waste of my time. Sure, if I'd read the book, I'm sure I would have enjoyed it, but I didn't. There was far too much of the trio walking the country, 28 Days Later style. Hermione's winter collection. How many jumpers does a girl need when she's on the run?
She's got the infinite bag, though. She's got the Mary Poppins bag.
Plain old sitting around in tents. If the ticket vendor had just said to me, look, Voldemort steals Dumbledore's wand. Da-da-da-da-da-da. Can't read that, can't read that, can't read that, can't read that.
Exactly.
They die. And handed me a 2011 Britain's Most Beautiful Vistas calendar, the experience would have been roughly the same, and I'd have a calendar to show for it at the end.
Bah humbug.
Indeed. Final comment from Guy in New Zealand. Though I enjoyed the latest Potter installment, I left the cinema feeling as though I'd actually just watched part of a TV miniseries, in so much as it had moved the story on a little, but lacked beginning, middle and end.
I disagree. Somebody tweeted Wittertainment either last night or this morning with the best short review of the film, which is Harry on Camping.
Which is excellent. Wish we'd thought of that.
Yes.
And we'll pretend.
I will pretend that we did.
That we did.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's film review.
Megamind, 3D Digimation, which gains nothing from being 3D, but hey ho, stop me if you've heard this one. Directed by Tom McGrath, who was a director on Madagascar 2, but more importantly, was he did a voice on, is it Monsters vs. Aliens, one of those. Anyway, apparently, this was originally called Mastermind, but then they found out that the people who made Mastermind, that would be us, wouldn't it? Own the copyright on Mastermind. Although that never explained why it was that there was a board game called Mastermind. Maybe that predated
it. That was the one where you had to
align
little colours behind
it. There was a picture of a man with a beard with a woman standing behind him in a cocktail, not in a ball gown for some reason.
I had quite a handicap playing that game and still do.
Because?
Well, because it's a Tottenham thing, right? If you're I can't use the colour red, see? So automatically, everyone knew that,
superstitious.
That I wasn't going to put the colour red behind the mastermind shade.
Very good.
Is that stupid behaviour?
That is very stupid behaviour, yes. Anyway, so then it was called Ubermind or Albermind. Anyway, it ended up as Megamind. Story is, quite a funny story, two potential super beings are both thrown off their destructo planets at the same time, both arrive on Earth at the same time. One of them is grows up to be Metro Man, as voiced by Brad Pitt, who's heroic and wonderful. The other one is dorky and weird and realises that he can't actually be fabulous and good, so on. So will become evil, right? So Will Ferrell, Brad Pitt as Dorky, and so Metro Man and Megamind, which is an interesting little idea, the idea that the guy becomes evil because all the good has been taken up by Metro Man. Except, listen to this clip and tell me whether this doesn't remind you of A, The Incredibles, B, Dr. Evil from Austin Powers, C, the despicable person from Despicable Me, and D, any of the above. Here's a clip. Megamind.
Oh, bravo, Metro Man. Yes, I can play along too.
Should have known you'd try to crash the party.
Oh, I intend to do more than crashes. This is a day you and Metrocity shall not soon forget.
It's pronounced Metro City.
Oh, potato, tomato, potato, tomato.
We all know how this ends, with you behind bars.
Oh, I'm shaking in my custom baby seal leather boots. You will leave Metrocity, or this will be the last you ever hear of Roxanne Ritchie. Huh?
Roxanne. Don't panic, Roxy. I'm on my way.
I'm not panicking.
In order to stop me, you need to find me first, Metro Man.
We're at the abandoned observatory.
Aha! No, we're not. Don't listen to her. She's crazy.
Tina Fey in there as well. So, what's to say? On the one hand, the you know, the voice characterizations are quite funny, and there are a couple of good jokes. The Metrocity joke is pretty much the best gag. And there's also a very strange gag about him saying Olu instead of hello, which seems very much like it might well have been made up on the draw, you know, while they were knocking about doing the voiceovers. The animation itself is fine, doesn't need to be 3D. The design is very much like the design from Monsters vs. Aliens. The interesting sort of central crux of it is, if... I mean, they were described in production as what happens if Lex Luthor beats Superman and suddenly there isn't anyone to fight against. So the interesting idea is, in order for an evil overlord to have any purpose in life, he has to be up against somebody. And what very quickly happens is that Megamind realises that having destroyed or defeated Metro Man, apparently, he doesn't have anyone to fight against. So he has to go off and create somebody to fight against, which is a nice little central idea. So it's like, you know, the two superheroes, that's a nice idea. I'll become evil because the good position is already taken. That's a good idea. Then when I'm evil and I haven't got any, what do I do with it? That's fine. But it ain't original. It is passingly funny. The animation is up to... It's every bit as much, you know, poshly done as we've now come to expect. But I have to say, it is, again, nothing that looks like it's going to have... I mean, the weird thing about it was, halfway through watching it, I suddenly realised that I had probably been quite unfair to The Incredibles. And The Incredibles was probably a much better and more groundbreaking movie than I had allowed it. I mean, I thought The Incredibles was too long, and I thought the whole sort of Bergman-esque stuff at the beginning would have lost the young audience. Turned out I was completely wrong about that. I know many, many, you know, young viewers who really, really like Incredibles. And watching this, you think... It's a movie that's come after these ideas have been explored in other movies. Doesn't mean they're not still funny. Doesn't mean the jokes aren't still good. Doesn't mean that the voiceovers are, you know, don't give you a couple of good gags. But it ain't nothing to write home about. And whilst it will entertain whilst you're in there, it's not something that's going to stay with you in the way of a classic fairy tale. It doesn't have longevity. It doesn't have legs.
Listener Ben Sutherland on @Witattainment says it was indeed a listener who came up with huge action. They also suggested Nicole Kindling. It was when Australia was out. Yes, all of it, he says. And I think we were at Wimbledon. I think now I can remember reading out the email. Actually, we're on right on the roof at Wimbledon when that came out. Very good.
Well, we're on the subject of something having legs. Can I introduce you to Secretariat?
Yes, indeed. This is the most famous horse called
the most famous horse. I know nothing about horse racing at all. As I said, Eleanor was there from Radio 5 and she said, you know, do you know about this? I said, no, I don't know at all. Secretariat, rings any bells to you?
Not especially.
Were you familiar with Seabiscuit before the movie?
Not especially.
No, that means no.
No.
Okay, so this is the story of the greatest racehorse that ever lived, apparently. Competed for the Triple Crown in the 70s, and I won't spoil the ending by telling you
That's a rugby trophy, Triple Crown.
Well, it's a horse racing thing. Okay. And I don't want to tell you whether or not...
It's not a rugby film, then?
No, you know, actually, the horse would have been quite interesting in the... on the rugby pitch. But I don't want to spoil the ending by telling you whether or not the horse manages to get this triple thing, OK?
The triple crown.
It's directed by Randall Wallace, who wrote Braveheart and Pearl Harbor, and who brings to this story of a horse up against incredible odds all the subtlety and historic accuracy he brought to those previous projects. There's a lovely thing in the press notes in which Randall Wallace is quoted saying, I have a saying, let's not let the facts get in the way of the truth. And certainly that's not something that Mr. Wallace has done in the past. You'll remember that Pearl Harbor, when it went into production under the tagline, this time we win. Okay, so from Diane Lane's point of view, and I like Diane Lane very much, she presumably saw this as her blind side because she's playing a feisty and yet to some extent kind of, you know, slightly frumpy southern woman who suddenly finds herself taking on the sporting world, which is very, very male-led, and, you know, a story of the triumph over incredible odds. It is a script which is literally chiselled from archetypes. So we've got Margot Martindale as the mumsy. She's called Miss Ham, and her role is Ham. Her role is literally to walk into the room at regular intervals and announce that people have had strokes or have been taken ill or something's happening out in the farm and then look a bit concerned. You've got Scott Glenn as the old guy to whom the strokes and the things that we need to be looking concerned about are happening. You've got Nelson Ellis, who's the stable hand, who is so, if he was any more good, he would indeed be sanctified. You've got James Cromwell as the millionaire, who's incredibly nice, and you can tell all the way through it what he really wants to do is say, that'll do, pig, that'll do. And then you've got John Malkovich as the trainer, right, as the eccentric trainer. Here's how the eccentricity of the trainer is portrayed, and there may be some historical basis for this. He wears crazy hats, crazy ties, crazy shirts, crazy jackets, and he acts the whole thing with his teeth, and he is unable to close his mouth at any point. I mean, it is the John Malkovich off-the-shelf cuckoo performance. I mean, literally, there are whole bits in which John Malkovich is acting like this, and he's standing around in funny clothes, unable to shut his mouth, and being John Malkovich, and everyone's going, isn't that brilliant? This John Malkovich.
So you're sucking a lemon.
But that's what he looks like. It's like somebody has CGI'd out the lemon, but his mouth is still standing like that. Now, that said, the film is not without some redeeming interest, partly from my point of view. I didn't know how it ended. I mean, I genuinely didn't. And the narrative goes some way towards suggesting to you that it's going to end in a different way to the way it does. That's obviously the, you know, let's do everything to lend some areas surprise to this, because apparently people who know Secretariat... Do you know who Secretariat is? Was?
No. You're pointing at Tom as though he's coming
I've just
to read
sat
the
down.
News.
No, hello, Tom.
What's happening?
Yeah, Secretariat. Ever heard of Secretariat? Well, it's incredibly famous. apparently, as I said, I had no idea. But the really interesting thing is this. There are three races, okay? Triple, right? Three races. Okay. The first race and the third race are reconstructions. And they're done with now these tiny little cameras, which you can literally stick on a horse's blinkers. So you get the horse's eye view of the track. And that stuff, it's amazing.
So is this the Kentucky Derby? Followed by the Preakness Stakes and then the Belmont Stakes.
That's right.
That's the Triple
Crown.
The
Preakner one in the middle is actually the most interesting part of the film, in which rather than having the, you know, we're actually horse's eye view, we're right there on the horse, we're holding onto
Look
the horse's mane, we're
action.
Doing all this stuff. Yeah, fine,
everyone
fine.
Take cover.
Stop it. Is the family of the lead character played by Diane Lane, played very well by her, incidentally, sitting around watching the television, in which the race, because they've always thought we can't simply do what one race, two race, three race. There's only a certain amount of up close horse action that you can do. So at one point, for one of the races, the family sit round and watch the race playing out on television, which I imagine, I don't think this is actually the historical footage of the horse running this race on television. And it's the one moment of invention in the film which you go, that's smart, very good. You didn't just cut that from a TV movie of the week, triumph over incredible odds. This is the quote here. This is a story about heart, secretariats, and the heart of the woman who owned him. Both were greater than anyone had imagined. And the whole film is at that tone, except the bit where they all sit around and watch the television. You go, you know what, Randall? That's a smart idea. And I bet you it wasn't his. I bet you somebody else in the cutting room went, Randall, this second race... Shall we do something different with it? But Diane Lane's very, very good. It's fabulous to see her on screen for so long. I wish she'd had a slightly better role. I wish it hadn't been quite such a kind of off-the-peg character. It ain't going to do the same as Blindside. And there are very few surprises in it, with the exception of the moment when they sit around and watch the television, in which it suddenly becomes interesting for about 3 minutes.
Dr. Robert Smith.
But I didn't hate it.
Dr. K's review of Gods and Men has made me want to rush out through the snow and watch it immediately.
Good.
Unfortunately, it doesn't get to my outpost in the northwest, in the excellent cinema, the Duke's Theatre in Lancaster, till the middle of January.
I know. I'm sorry. I have talked about this before. with these kind of movies, you do
go
have
on,
to make
yourself.
And I wish we lived in a world in which that wasn't the case, in which your local, you know, cinema was showing this right now, day and date. And that's why multiplex culture is eating the world alive, and it's not good.
An email from Richard. Richard Main says, my girlfriend recently got a job as a broadcast assistant at a local radio station, making tea, rubbing egos and booking guests. As an avid podcast listener, you can imagine my delight when she mentioned in passing that she'd booked none other than Dr. Mark Kermode to appear on one of the shows, almost definitely flogging his book. However, I was dismayed to find out her knowledge of him was only extended to him being some film critic. Well, with this in mind, last Friday we were in her car driving home for her dad's birthday, and I realised this presented a rare opportunity to listen to the programme live and educate my girlfriend in the ways of Witter. We tuned in just in time to hear the story of one of your listeners who had crashed his van into a tree whilst listening to the programme.
We both
questioned just how someone could get so lost in Wittertainment as to crash their vehicle.
Yeah.
A few minutes later,
Tow truck arrived.
Dr. K's review of Deathly Hallows Part 1 was the rather surreal backing track to the swapping of insurance details as we had crashed into the back of a lorry on the A14 in near stationary traffic.
Everyone all right, I hope?
Luckily, everyone was fine.
Good.
But as a first experience of the show for my girlfriend, it proved memorable. Keep up the Wittertainment. I will once again be listening whilst in the car this afternoon, despite the obvious dangers this appears to possess. Well, obviously enjoy the show, but if you're driving, you know, zone in on the car in front as opposed to the good doctor's voice.
Exactly.
Because that could be rather disturbing. Give us something interesting which might be available in a Cinecast cinema near us.
Let's try and clear three by quarter two. So Miral is the latest from Julian Schnabel, who made Basquiat and Before Nightfall, which I didn't care for very much. Then The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which I just loved. And then since then, that Lou Reed performing Berlin live. It's based on a semi-autobiographical novel by Rula Gebrail. Described, it's basically a story of four Arab-Israeli women. Goes from the period Israel 1948 is the birth of the State of Israel to 1994, the Oslo Agreement, which at the end we are told, you know, still has yet to be honoured. Here's an interesting thing that when Julian Schnabel read the book, he said that he found it very, very cinematic. He immediately saw it as a cinematic story and he wanted to make it into a film. The interesting thing about it is that despite the great work of Diving Bell and the Butterfly, I think he's kind of come unstuck in that this isn't a very cinematic film at all. It's got a number of intertwining stories. I mean, at the centre of it, we have Miral herself, who grows up in this orphanage, which is looked after by, in many ways, one of the central women of the film. And it's about her struggle for independence, her rebellion against her father, her politicisation, her as a sort of coming-of-age story. But it is amidst many other things. What it essentially attempts to do is to weave a political thread through personal stories, through the lives of these four women who become emblematic of what is happening in the Israeli-Palestine relations of a very, very complex period of history. Now, I mean, I have to say that personally, I thought, I mean, if you look, for example, at a film like Ilya Suleiman's The Time That Remains, which came out on DVD just recently, which took almost exactly the same time span, and looked at the story in a much more interesting, much more cinematic way. The problem with this is it kind of felt rather lumpen. I mean, the performance is very good. Frida Pinto gives it a very best shot. But it felt, in the end, like it was wading its way through history and doing the personal political, but doing it in a somewhat perfunctory way. I don't doubt for one minute that it's heartfelt. But I think the irony of it is that having managed to take Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which is a story about incredible physical confinement, about somebody who is paralysed, the only thing they can move is one eyelid, and yet the film has such artistic flights of fancy that it really becomes a cinematic experience. This didn't manage to interweave its personal stories anything like as well. And I have to confess that although I thought the story was important and it was being told from the heart of its creators, I did find it rather hard going and frankly a bit boring occasionally. There are also two small and oddly comparable movies out, to The Be All and End All and Easier With Practice. Be All and End All is a small independent British movie, peculiar drama. Do you remember that the David Morrissey film? Is it called Don't Worry About Me? Just recently, the one that he directed. set against the backdrop of, you know, a couple in Liverpool. Actually, this shares many of the same locations, the beach with the Gormleys and all the rest of it. It's a story about two 15-year-old boys. At the beginning of it, they're seen going out getting drunk. They appear to be hungover. One of them then collapses and turns out is very ill. Whilst he's in hospital, he reveals to his best friend that actually he does not want to die a virgin. And the rest of the movie then plays out as to whether or not he, you know, his friend can solve this for him. There's a moment very early on when his friend steals the medical records, finds out what he thinks is wrong with his mate, looks it up on the internet and says, actually, you're very ill, you know, you haven't got long for this world. And the way that the film seems to be playing out is that that isn't the case. You know, in the standard way this story would play out is the friend is wrong. The whole thing about the he's misread the diagnosis. And you're sort of inclined to think it's going that way because you've got, for example, Lisa Tarbuck as this sort of very, you know, feisty nurse who's, you know, always telling them off and yet somehow on their side. And there are sort of carry-on camping moments of humour in which he's wheeling his friend out in a shopping trolley in order to, you know, get him to a place where his wish can be fulfilled. So on the one hand you have that. On the other hand, the film has a much darker, much different purpose going on. And I never thought the two sides of it reconciled themselves. I never thought it quite managed to decide exactly what kind of film it wanted to be. That said, it has very, very charming lead performances. The two young actors are very good. And I wanted to like it more than in the end I did. I think there are individual moments in it that work. I think it has a problem. For example, if it was more broadly comedic, it would have less of a problem with its sexual politics than it manages to have. And I think it just in the end couldn't quite decide what. I mean, you look at a film like Gregory's Girl. It's not that because it's a 15 certificate movie and therefore it's maybe managed to sort of, you know, price itself out of its own market. I think there is definite promise in here. I just think it didn't hang together. The ending was just didn't work for me at all. And I was ultimately disappointed, although I did think that individual things about it were interesting. There's also this Easier with Practice, which has won a number of independent spirit awards. I think at the Edinburgh Film Festival, it won the best new international film. Stars a guy you may recognise from The Hurt Locker. Story is two boys, Chalk and Cheese, brothers out on the road. One of them is an author writing terrible short stories, doing a tour of colleges and bookstores, reading his awful prose. The other one is his brother, who basically is out for a good time and wants to pick up girls. The sort of the author character, who's very, very introverted, one night in a hotel, answers the telephone, somebody rings up, it's a woman with a glamorous voice on the end of it and says, what are you wearing? And then they develop a relationship at long distance. The whole of the rest of the film then plays out about somehow this guy, who's very introverted, is more able to have a fulfilling relationship with somebody on the end of the phone than he is with the people around him. And it sounds terribly contrived and it sounds like it's going to be awfully awkward, but actually it was kind of much more charming than I expected. It was better played than I expected. It teased out its themes rather better than I expected. It's interesting because there's another movie coming up called Catfish, which is about people meeting and having relationships at a distance over the internet. And of course, as you know, when you the whole thrust of this is these relationships at a distance never turn out to be what they seem to be. The whole essence of if it's on the internet or on television, you have no idea who the other person is. And the story, which it says is based on a true story, inspired by a true story, makes much of this. But considering the simplicity of the idea, if you remember, there was a film several years ago when you and I were both at Radio 1 called Julia Has Two Lovers, about a woman who at the beginning of the day answers a phone, it's a wrong number, and she starts having a conversation with a guy on the other end of the phone, and then she stays on the phone with him the whole day, and during the course of the day they basically have a relationship entirely at a distance. And David Duchovny was in it, and I remember saying the great fantasy element of that for a British audience is that in America you don't get charged by the minute for the telephone call. In England, you're on the phone that long, it would cost you a fortune. And he said, yeah, you should have called it Julia Has Two Lovers, but they repossessed her house. Well, this, oddly enough, owes something to that film. It's not without flaws, and it's a single idea teased out about as far as it will go, but there were moments in it that were kind of charming.
Julia calls Dial-A-Disc. That would have been fun. Did you ever call Dial-A-Disc?
Is that the one when you could ring up and it would play you one of the hits in the hit parade?
It would. Down the phone. That was so thrilling. Imagine that. So, Mike from Finchley, you mentioned David Morrissey.
Yes.
I would like to take this opportunity, says Mike in Finchley, to offer an apology on behalf of the entire Wittertainment Collective to Mr. David Morrissey.
Why?
Despite his best attempt at looking inconspicuous behind a baseball cap and glasses, I couldn't help but notice that I was standing next to him in the queue in a certain North London coffee shop last weekend, and I couldn't resist the temptation to ask him, as politely as possible, I should point out, if it would be appropriate to say hello to him in a Kermode and Mayo fashion. I'm sure I could detect a hint of weary resignation in his voice when he told me, Don't worry about it, it happens all the time. Yet even so, he was utterly charming, friendly and gracious in his acceptance of my fawning praise of his performance in the recent TV drama Thorn. So, Mr. Morrissey, please accept my apologies and those of all the other listeners to this programme for not allowing you to get your Saturday morning cup of coffee in peace. Mike from Finchley, Mike Hirschhorn, it says. Then in brackets, yes, Mark, that Hirschhorn. He's my brother, whatever that means. Does that mean anything to you?
Nope.
No, absolutely nothing at all. Hello to David.
Yeah, I'm sure it should do. And I'm sure that as soon as I find it, I'll go, oh, yes, of course.
So we apologise for making David Morrissey's life a misery and Jason as well. I think we detected a slight weariness in his tone last time he came in as well. Gary Yahal is another of our listeners in Melbourne. He says, I found myself doing a Google... He's clearly just found us from somewhere. I found myself doing a Google image search for Mr. Mayo every day because he's in my head. Every time I hear his voice, I picture the Australian comedian and TV presenter Paul McDermott. Okay, I just checked him up. He's quite a good-looking lad.
Is he?
Really, yeah. Simon, you look far more conventional in a good way than your voice would suggest, whereas Mark looks far more rough around the edges than his voice would suggest. That is all he says. Keep up. Yes.
You're doing one of these every week. You're fat, you're hugs, old, hugs. You're grey. Hey, I had an email this week, and this was such a thrill, from Jesse Birdsall.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. After all these years...
Remind younger listeners.
Jesse Birdsall is a very good actor. He was in a number of... He was in Wish You Were Here as the kind of the greaser guy in Wish You Were Here. And then he was in soaps like El Dorado. And he has a great interest in 50s music. And he does repro 7-inch vinyl, I think. And anyway, it was just because I kept getting confused with him. People always thought that I was him. And I had written something about, you know, I wonder whether he gets it the other way. And he wrote me a really nice email saying, actually, I have been invited to film screenings on your behalf. So that was, and he was very nice.
Just a word on unfortunate events, which there's an unfortunate Dumbledore event. And we were talking about unfortunate events in the current Harry Potter
film. Yeah, which we're not allowed to talk about.
This from Nick Bailey, who says, with all this talk of unfortunate events, may I suggest that your reviews regularly include the number of unfortunate events we're likely to expect in a film? So you'd have a new unfortunate event rating. Some all-out action features might be a 20 or 30 unfortunate event film, whereas a Pixar animation might have a UER of just one or two. Interested in that?
Well, it would mean that I'd have to note them down, and that's far too sight and sound for me, to be honest.
He's also said, on a recent flight to Korea for my wedding, congratulations, Dr. Nick Bailey, I watched Robin Hood on the in-flight system. I enjoyed being able to flick back and forth between the English language and Korean dubbed version, I can tell you that the
Korean dub was closer.
Exactly.
Very good.
There you go. So good. What else do we
so
have?
So, very quickly, Rare Exports Christmas Tale, which is a finished twist on the Father Christmas story, which is essentially Miracle on 34th Street meets The Thing. Snowbound Mountains archaeological dig uncovers frozen old men, basically. Children start disappearing. Old men with beards start being seen around. This is getting back, apparently, to the Norse origins of the Santa myth, in which it's a character who comes into your house and steals and punishes children rather than sort of bringing them presents. And... I mean, it's interesting. Started life as there's a couple of short films, one from 2003 about hunters attempting to catch Santa, and one from 2005 called The Official Rare Export Safety Instructions. I mean, it is a black comedy with certain flashes of invention and a certain dark charm in the way of those vodka adverts, you know, but I don't think it works as a full-length feature. I think that it does look to me like a single idea that's expanded out into a full-length feature. But it's not, I mean, it's not without a certain charm. There's a kind of oddity value to it. It's what would be referred to in certain places as a cult hit in the making. I think it's a good idea. I think there are moments of it that are great. I don't think it sustained itself over there. Certainly no masterpiece. Which brings us on to Monsters. And we've said a lot about Monsters up until now, but this is the week that's finally released, directed by Gareth Edwards. $500,000 is the budget, although, as somebody has said recently, it'd be a shame if the budget actually became the story as opposed to the film itself. So the story is two characters attempting to make their way back to the American border. One is a journalist who's been told by his boss to bring his daughter back. They have to go through an infected zone. This is in the aftermath of an alien outbreak which has happened. A NASA space probe has returned to Earth. It has brought with it alien spores. They have grown into aliens, and the aliens are now contained within a huge but contained infected area. Key thing about the movie is, as Gareth Edwards said, if Independence Day was Iraq, this is Afghanistan. This is the point at which everyone's just got used to it. Everyone's just got used to the fact that there are space aliens in the background. And in many ways, despite the attention that there has been to the special effects, the most important thing about the film is the story of two characters finding each other, getting on with each other, not getting on with each other, falling out with each other as they go on a road trip, which takes them across some incredible scenery, in the background of which happens to be these strange space aliens, defined in many ways by a scene in which they're in a hotel, they're goofing around, they're talking to each other, and on the television is the War of the Worlds footage, and they're not even noticing it. Here's a brief clip.
You know, dolphins can only hold their breath for like 12 minutes. So the question is when they sleep, do they swim? Or do they just stay kaput and float? Have you ever, do you know that?
I know what?
That dolphins can only hold their breath for like 12 minutes?
No.
They're mammals.
Does that mean they have belly buttons?
You know, they do have belly buttons. You're a marine biologist, aren't you? That's what you do. You look like a marine biologist. Biologist. That's a weird word.
See, as you can see from this, that is what an awful lot of the dialogue in the film is like.
It just sounds really tedious.
No, but it's not. What I'm saying is, it's not monster movie dialogue. Monster movie dialogue goes like this. Dr. Necessiter, what's happened since the huge alien probe fell out there? Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because since then, the aliens have spored in the trees in this area, and now they're... Oh, no! Look out behind you! It's a giant walking squid! Actually, all the way through Monsters, it's that. It's, you know, dolphins have belly buttons. I don't know. I kind of like you. I've got to get through this border thing. And so what you have at the center of this is this peculiar hybrid that it's, in fact, a little sort of independently spirited character study about two people who just happen to be taking their journey across a desolate, semi-post-apocalyptic background in which there are monsters.
If you heard Gareth Edwards, the director, on the programme last week, we were talking about the improvised script, which is not in a Mike Lee improvised script kind of way, where they've worked on it for weeks
and then written it down.
And then written it down. That, and I think you probably got the, you're hearing that clip, you go, well, I get it now. That really did sound like we were eavesdropping on a couple who were just in a bar.
And it's a very interesting process. I mean, I have to say, I've seen the film a couple of times now. The first time I saw it, I was slightly thrown. I could not quite get a handle on what kind of film it was. And I wondered whether it would have been possible to make the film without the monsters at all. I was very interested when I spoke to Gareth Edwards. He said actually he had the same feeling. Was it possible to just not have monsters in a film called Monsters at all? What's really interesting is the idea that the monsters are a presence. As we know, he's conjured them incredibly from his laptop, very advanced laptop necessarily, but he has done that. And yet it's created this sort of semi-documentary, sort of cinema verite, you know, realist, Italian neo-realist, since we're doing all this.
Hang on, what is it? Italian neo-realist?
Done cinema verite, so, and I sort of felt that we ought to do.
I don't know if I've even seen an Italian neo-realist film.
No, I was being fatuous.
Well, what sort of film would that be?
I was being fatuous, The Seeker. But let's not get this, because we've only got three minutes.
Did you just make up a genre?
No, then? Italian neorealism is a proper genre.
Like what?
What's it like? Well,
I want to get one out now.
Bicycle Thieves.
Right.
Moving on. Actually, no, that probably... Well, maybe it does. Who cares? Anyway, the point about it is that you have, on the one hand, this downbeat realism, a British kitchen sink.
What?
British kitchen sink realism. And on the other hand, you have the monsters in the background. And the interest of the movie is the intersection between those two things. Pasolini. Between those two elements. The fantasy element and the realism element. And one of the things Gareth Edwards said, if you go to all that trouble to make the special effects seem realistic, why wouldn't you go to exactly the same amount of trouble to make the people seem realistic? I think there is a possibility that some people will go along to see monsters expecting to see a monster movie. Duh. And not get what it is they paid for, in the same way that The American is not a thriller. So let's be clear about this. It is a character study. It's a film about a relationship between two people. There are clearly political implications to it, whether or not they were intended. I mean, it's a story about people trying to get across an American border. And so therefore there is a political immigration dimension to the whole thing, in as much as you could say the same thing about Machete, number 10 in the current box office. But it is, in the end, a story about people in a strange, off-kilter, odd world which has become normalised, and the dramatic interest is in the normalisation of their human interaction against this extraordinary background. And that said, there are a couple of set pieces, special effects set pieces, that are quite beautiful, didn't you think?
I think it's absolutely stunning, and it reminded me a bit of Stromboli.
You've just looked up Italian neorealism on your iPad.
Bellissima. And a little bit of bitter rice in there, did you think?
You are just Mr. Gadget-tastic.
Roma Città Aperta from 1945, the key Italian neorealist
text.
That was the key moment, with a little bit of Fellini's I Vitelloni.
Yes.
Which just sounds like Leave It Alone.
Leave It Alone.
Fellini's
Leave It Alone.
Really rubbish English neorealist spin-off from the Italian neorealist.
I'm never going to say that sort of thing again.
So the box office top 10 was very interesting, I think, in giving us some really good movies. However, the movie of the week is...
Of Gods and Men tied with Monsters. So, which is interesting because there is a film called Gods and Monsters. So it's Of Gods and Monsters is the film of the week.
Well, that was the Wittertaining podcast for this particular week. Thank you very much indeed for listening. I think we were okay today.
Well, I was very pleased with the fact that we got through as many movies as we did. And I'm very pleased with my decision to start with Of Gods and Men, so I didn't find myself having to suddenly nail it in the last 3 minutes.
Is this going to be a new thing whereby you're actually going to...
Try and review some films?
Well, no, for the movie of the week not to be done in the last 15 seconds
of
the programme.
Yes, it is. It is a new policy. Because somebody actually said to me, why is it that you do that? And I said, I never plan it. I just run out of time. So they said, well, why don't you start with it? And I went, oh,
that's a good bit of
10 years it took us to figure that out.
We haven't been doing it that long, have we?
10 years in, isn't it, in May?
We need to celebrate.
Shall we do it?
Yeah, we should do that.
Fine.
Thank you very much indeed for listening. I've been Mark Kermode.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Two.
To whom?
On digital and online.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.